This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. President Bush has put an overhaul of Social Security at the top of his domestic agenda. Last week, the system's trustees issued their annual report with fresh data on the financial problems currently faced by Social Security. The report said that in the year 2017, the system will begin to pay out more in benefits than it collects in tax revenue. Each year after that, Social Security will have to tap the bonds in its trust fund to make up the difference. Then in 2041, according to the trustees, the bonds will run out and the system, as it's set up now, becomes insolvent. At that point, without any other changes, Social Security will be able to pay just 74% of the benefits promised under current law. The president's proposal for private accounts doesn't address this solvency problem, though Mr. Bush argues the accounts make Social Security a better deal for young workers. The president sees the accounts as a sort of sweetener to offset the spinach course, that is, the benefit cuts and tax hikes necessary to make Social Security solvent. But even spinach can be quite palatable with the right recipe, and there are many formulas on the table for fixing the system. In this hour, we'll talk to guests about what the options are, but we want your views too. What would you prefer? Higher taxes for the well-off? That's always a popular one. A hike in the retirement age? Benefit cuts across the board? Join in the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Later in the hour, an update on today's 8.2 magnitude earthquake off the coast of Sumatra and the new business of identity theft insurance. But first, Social Security solvency. This isn't a conversation about private accounts, but about the long-term financial health of the system. And to put the challenge into perspective, we are joined now by Joanne Barnhart, Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. She's with us from Social Security headquarters in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Commissioner Barnhart.
Thank you, John. I'm delighted to be with you today.
There are a lot of numbers involved in describing Social Security's problems. What do you think is the best way to help people understand the challenges it faces?
Well, I think, first of all, the numbers that you gave are very important. The fact that, as the trustee report indicated just last week, in 2017, the system will start to pay out more in benefits each year than it takes in, a very important number. And in 2041, absent any action, the Social Security benefits paid will equal about 74% of the promised or scheduled benefits today. And the way I put that in perspective for people is to say, suppose someone told you today that you were going to have to take a 26% pay cut. Wouldn't you say to yourself, gee, didn't someone see that coming? Couldn't we have taken less drastic action?
Let's talk about what's causing this problem as well, because I think that helps to put the solutions in perspective. The problem is really demographic, isn't it?
It's absolutely demographics. I mean, if you look back over the program's history with the pay-as-you-go system, meaning the workers of today pay the benefits for the beneficiaries today, we at one time had as many as 40 workers for each person who was receiving benefits. Today, that number is around 3.3, soon to be decreasing to a little over 2, and eventually below 2 workers per beneficiary.
Now, the trustees' report suggested how to solve the problem in very stark terms. Let's talk about some of those numbers. It suggested an immediate tax hike of about 2% or an immediate benefit cut about 13% to solve the problem. Now, that doesn't sound horrible. I mean, it doesn't sound like a horrible crisis, I guess.
Well, I think one of the things that I need to clarify is while the trustee report put the magnitude of the financing problem in the terms you've just described, they weren't recommending the tax increases or those benefit cuts as solutions to the problem, but rather simply trying to quantify what it would require in terms of tax increases or benefit cuts to solve the problem. And I do think that that's one of the reasons that people have started to look for other options.
Mm-hmm. I think we should clarify now that we're not talking about those immediate tax or benefit cuts. And most people would agree, although not everyone, most people would agree that seniors who are already retired or near retirement aren't going to see any benefit cuts.
I think it's a very, very important point, and I'm glad you brought that up. I always try to almost start every single discussion of this issue making it clear that current retirees and near retirees can have great confidence in the system, as they always have. I think where that confidence starts to slip and becomes more acute is for the younger generation, for my son, for the grandchildren of today.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine this happening, but what happens in 2041? If the Congress has done nothing, what does the person who's sitting in your chair do? Did benefits simply drop?
Well, that's certainly one of the options. I mean, quite frankly, that's the one that's most talked about. It's not exactly clear. We haven't been presented with that situation, as you know, in the past. And the fact of the matter is that the government simply cannot, a government program can't pay out money that it doesn't have. And so in 2041, one of the options would be to look at what the total amount of money is that's available, the total number of people who are eligible for benefits, divide that out, and that's how you come up with only 74% of benefits being payable.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Social Security Administration's Office of the Actuary has done some calculations on a whole range of options. Give us an example of what it might take to balance the system if we were going to cut benefits over for a certain group of people or raise the cap on payroll taxes on income subject to the payroll tax.
Well, the trustees report indicates that about 1.92% of the deficit for Social Security long-term financing is about 1.92% of payroll, which would mean that the payroll tax would have to be increased today 1.92% in order to make up the financing shortfall for the future.
Mm-hmm. How about in terms of raising the cap on payroll subject to taxes? It's at $90,000 now.
I think maybe what I ought to do there is just take a moment to explain that currently the people pay, workers of today pay Social Security taxes on salary up to $90,000 a year. And I think what you're talking about is lifting that cap. And commonly what's talked about is raising that to $140,000 a year, because that would raise it to a level that would equal 90% of payroll. And in the past, that is actually what taxes have been paid on. So I think that's what you're talking about.
And that would solve about, 40 to 45% of the problem, something like that?
It solves part of the problem, but I think one of the things we need to keep in mind, and you know, hear this term sustainable solvency, and one of the reasons that's so important is if you look, typically we look at Social Security over the financing over a 75-year time period, and the question is this: if the whatever action is taken at the end of the 75-year time period, are the trust funds stable and moving upwards in terms of assets on the plus side? In other words, right now we have a $1.6 trillion surplus in our Social Security trust fund. Or at the end of the 75 years, are the trust funds moving down again, so that really what we've done is simply repeat history and take action that 75 years from now puts us in the same position that we're in today?
You know, there's a lot of confusion about the Social Security trust fund, which is necessary to keep the system solvent until 2041. Some people suggest the money has been spent by the Congress for other things, or that the bonds in the trust fund are just IOUs that can be ignored. Is the trust fund real, and will it help Social Security?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because in many respects, I refer to myself as a mythbuster as the Social Security debate plays out. And one of the things that's important to clarify always when this issue of Congress spending the Social Security Trust Fund comes up is that historically, since the program's inception, payroll taxes contributed to Social Security have been posted against the trust fund and then used to purchase government securities, and the funds actually used by Congress to fund other government programs. That's not a new phenomenon. In fact, in 1983, when we had a financing problem and Congress had to take action to solve it, we had a situation where the trust funds actually the bonds had to be called in, and the government backed them with the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Barnhart. We appreciate your joining us today. Joanne Barnhart is the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. She joined us from headquarters in Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks again.
John.
Now that we have a sense of the problem, we turn to some of the possible solutions. Here to help us is Maya McGinnis, President of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget and Director of the Fiscal Policy Program at the New America Foundation. Welcome, Maya.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get going, I want to remind our listeners to call with your questions and proposals for Social Security. The number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Would you add anything to Commissioner Barnhart's comments about how we should view the challenge to the Social Security system?
I think she did an excellent job of explaining the problem. As you pointed out, it's a demographic problem in many ways. I think the issues of the trust fund are perhaps a little bit more complex in that, as the points have been reiterated over and over again, the bonds and the trust funds are real. They will get repaid. However, when you started off talking about some of the important numbers, I worry that the number 2041, which is when the trust fund will be exhausted, is a number that makes people think the problem is not as close to us as it really is in many ways, because if we wait until then, to have repaid the trust fund will have absorbed the resources from the rest of the budget. So while when you think about Social Security as a problem, the trust fund is there to help the program, when you think of the budget as a whole for this country, we don't want Social Security to squeeze out all the other areas of the budget. So you can't just think about Social Security and trust funds. You have to look at the budget as a whole.
So you're saying when the Social Security Administration goes to the government to redeem the bonds and the trust fund, it's going to strain the government's financial resources across the government.
That's right, because we set up a system where, yes, those dollars were spent on other things. There are real bonds in the trust funds, but the dollars that back them were spent on tax cuts or defense or education or a prescription drug program or lots of things that people think are good, but they weren't actually saved for Social Security. It's been very difficult to get the government to save the money. Therefore, using the trust funds is sort of a risky approach.
We're talking about long-term solutions to keep Social Security fiscally solvent. Do you have questions about what could fix the program or a proposal of your own? Call us at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm John Idsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idsty in Washington. We're weighing various options to keep Social Security solvent in the long run. What do you advocate? Raising the salary cap, raising the retirement age, or are you just raising your hands in exasperation? You're invited to join in the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest in Studio 3A is Maya McGinnis, President of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And also joining us now is Peter Orszag, Senior Fellow for Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for being with us, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your view of the situation? Will you take any exception with what you heard from Commissioner Barnhart or from Maya about describing the problem?
Not really. I mean, I think we all agree that this program faces an increase in cost over the next for the foreseeable future as the population ages. And the sooner that we act to address the implied deficit in the program, the better. I probably differ somewhat with Maya with regard to the meaning and significance of the trust fund. But the important point really is that we both agree that the program does need to be reformed and we should be moving ahead with implementing the changes that are necessary.
All right. Let's go to a caller, Alden in Wichita, Kansas. You're on the air, Alden.
Yeah, howdy.
Hi. You have a question or a comment?
Well, I had a suggestion back when President Bush first started talking about the privatization accounts. Seems to me that the problem is that if the government proposes a solution, it's forcing everybody to accept whatever they propose. I'd like to see us go with a choice system whereby if someone like me wants to receive Social Security based on needs, you know, whether I'm 70, 80, or whenever I get to be decrepit, then I should only have to pay taxes to support people who want Social Security when they need it. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other people who want to receive Social Security when they're 65 or 67 or at a certain set age should be given the choice to pay the taxes sufficient to support that system.
So you want a multiple choice page that gives you a checkoff about what kind of Social Security benefit you want and what kind of tax you want to pay?
Yeah, what I'd like to do is...
Let's ask our experts what they think about that. Thanks for the call, Alden. Maya McGinnis, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it poses a lot of challenges for a program that's basically universal and insurance. Many of the reasons that Social Security exists is that when we're 20, we're unlikely to probably make the best decisions for ourselves in retirement. So you'd be a little bit too optimistic, a little bit too cavalier about your retirement needs, and might make the wrong choices. There is, however, one plan that's out there. Senator Lindsey Graham came up with an idea where, in facing the challenges in the future, he said, you could raise your payroll taxes if you want benefits as large as the system currently is promising but can't pay, or pay the same payroll tax you currently do and benefits would be lowered. I think most people aren't as comfortable with changing the program so that it's less of a one size fits all and more individualized. There's just too many risks that might go along with it, but it's something to think about.
Peter Orszag, you've developed a comprehensive plan along with Peter Diamond at MIT to make Social Security solvent for the next 75 years and actually beyond, I guess. Give us a quick description of what you would do.
Oh, our plan combines benefit reductions and revenue increases in a progressive way, so we're protecting the most vulnerable members of society from the necessary changes and asking average earners for some modest sacrifices. We do ask higher earners for somewhat larger sacrifices, and I'd be happy to describe those. But I do think I want to return to the caller's question for a moment because I think this is an absolutely essential question. Social insurance, the kind that Social Security provides, really can't be voluntary because imagine trying to have, I don't know, your fire insurance voluntary. You only pay for it if you have a fire. That obviously doesn't work. We all need to be together in providing the protections that the program offers. And that's exactly what Social Security does. I'd also note with regard to some of the proposals, including Senator Graham's, to make various parts of the program voluntary or to offer choices, that virtually everywhere that those kinds of choices have been introduced abroad, they create incredible amounts of problems. For example, in the United Kingdom, they basically have that kind of approach where you can choose to stay in the existing system with a higher level of benefit, or get a reduction in your taxes and have the money flowing into an account. And that has created a huge number of problems, everything ranging from having to adjust the parameters for the worker's age so that people aren't gaming the program by going in and out at different ages, to a massive mis-selling scandal in which financial firms were telling workers that the accounts were the right things for them even when they were not. And the financial firms there have now had to pay billions of pounds in compensation to people who were misled. Basically, in this, for the core tier of retirement income, that bottom foundation, you want a benefit that's provided effectively in the form that Social Security already does, and choice belongs above and beyond that program, not within it, unfortunately.
All right. Let's go to another caller, Steve in Portland, Oregon. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, I have two questions, if I could. One is it possible that we could implement means testing so that wealthy retirees with income over, say, $100,000 a year or net worth over $5 million would forgo benefits? And then secondly, is it possible that we could combine a reduction in the percentage of the FICA tax while expanding it to those to income
above $90,000, the current
yes.
cap. Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much for the question, Maya McGinnis. I think you're interested in this whole question of means testing Social Security.
That's right.
Benefits.
I actually happen to be intrigued by both the ideas the caller put forth. I do think means testing is something we need to think about as a country. Politically, the environment is such as that people have promised not to touch benefits for current retirees or near retirees, or sometimes, you know, not even that near retirees, because that's a pretty powerful group of people right there. But I think the fairest way to think about Social Security reform is we really want to implement reforms that protect people who need the program the most. And if there are retirees who are not in need of their benefits and are perhaps even receiving more out of the system than they paid in, certainly I think that they should possibly be part of the solution. And means testing is one way to get at asking people who don't need their benefits to contribute back to the program in order for it to be there for people who really do rely on it. So I am certainly a supporter of looking into means testing as one of the options. I also think payroll tax reform, which the caller brought up, is something worth thinking about. The payroll tax in itself is a pretty bad tax. It's regressive. It hurts job creation. It's inefficient. There are a number of things to say about the payroll tax, and if there are ways to reform it from comprehensive reforms, which are things that I've thought about in the past, to lowering the rate but widening the base, all those ideas should be things that are contemplated. I agree.
Peter Orszag, what do you think?
Well, two comments. First, the caller had suggested that we would increase the maximum taxable earnings base above $90,000, but then also introduce an exemption at the lower end. That would not necessarily increase the base. It depends on the parameters. And for the vast majority of workers, or the net effect of that would be probably on net an increase in marginal tax rates. I don't necessarily object to it, but I don't think that the traditional way of analyzing tax changes in terms of bases and marginal rates would necessarily suggest that it was a positive development. In terms of means testing, a couple points are worth noting. One is usually there's a lot of rhetoric about what higher earners are getting out of Social Security, but it is important to remember that the best deal for under Social Security is for lower earners. There are very, very few higher earners who are getting out more than they put into the system after you do the analysis in the right way, which takes interest into account. And so there's just not a lot of money on the table there. It may be worth pursuing to some degree, but we can't hope that it will come close to restoring solvency.
Right. It's not going to solve 100% of the problem, maybe a few tens of percentage points.
It depends on
less
exactly how
half.
It's done. Right. Well under half.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to another caller. This is Betsy in Mazama, Washington. Hello, Betsy.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You've got a question or a comment?
Well, I had a comment, and I just came in on the last little bit of the means testing conversation, so I'm not sure if this applies or not, but something that my household's been thinking about just in trying to, you know, make the money that's in the pool last longer is more of a voluntary declining of taking your Social Security payment any given year that you are eligible. So a retiree who's eligible, if their financial situation is such that they don't really need that money, that they could decline it for that year and be given some sort of tax incentive for doing so.
Mm-hmm. This sort of gets at the notion of maybe raising the retirement age in a way, or allowing a floating retirement age, or allowing people to,
Well, this would be on the recipient's initiative to just say, you know, on a year-by-year basis, I'm in good shape this year, I don't want to take that draw, and I'm actually going to decline it. I'm not going to defer it, I'm going to decline it, and there would be some tax benefit to me for doing so.
Maya McGinnis, what do you think of that idea?
Again, because I think means testing is something politicians haven't been discussing just because they're worried about protecting current retirees. A voluntary means test, like the caller is talking about, is also something that I've thought about, sort of a voluntary send it back to the program. People who don't need their benefits don't have to keep it. Because one thing I'm struck by when I talk to people in the country, while politicians say, oh, retirees aren't going to be part of the solution, a lot of retirees would like to be. This is something that they want to help make strengthen the program for their kids and grandkids. I think if you want to have something where people give up part of their benefits, they need to know that those savings will go back into the program. They need to be promised that they won't be spent on other things. So it needs to be part of a comprehensive balanced plan where they know those savings will be there for Social Security. And just to the final point, I'm worried about having it offset by some kind of credit in the income tax, because while we're facing a big problem in Social Security, we're also facing a problem in Medicare. We're also facing a problem with big budget deficits. So there's not a lot of free money to go around right now. Unfortunately, we've been in a couple years where we've had a lot of giveaways on the tax and benefit side. It's now time to tighten our belt, and there's not a lot of ways to sweeten the pot right now.
Thanks for your call, Betsy.
Okay, thank you.
We got an email here from Sean. He asks, what about taxing capital gains and other types of income other than income from employment? Mm-hmm. That's Sean in St. Petersburg, Florida. What do you think of that, Peter? Peter Orszag.
I think it's a very interesting idea. There are proposals out there, for example, to retain the estate tax rather, or some form of an estate tax rather than repealing it altogether and dedicate that revenue to Social Security. As just one example, the estate tax could be retained with a $7 million per couple exemption, so no taxes up to $7 million in estates. And if the revenue above that threshold were dedicated to Social Security, you would solve roughly a quarter to a half of the 75-year deficit, depending on the accounting system that you used. The other thing that's interesting about that is that broadening the tax base to include capital-based taxes, like the estate tax or capital gains taxes, would implicitly invest the Social Security system in the stock market. Those taxes go up when the stock market goes up. So rather than having direct investment either through individual accounts in which individuals were investing in the stock market or having the trust fund invest directly in the stock market, this kind of dedication of capital-based taxes does the same thing in an implicit, diversified, decentralized way.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Peter, tell us a little bit more about your plan and some of the details of it.
Sure. For average earners, we have no reduction. Actually, for all earners, we have no reductions in benefits for those who are 55 and above. And I think that, again, reflects both a political reality but also a sound public policy motivation to avoid unexpected reductions in benefits for people who are already retired or near retirement. And then we gradually phase in a series of benefit changes over time. For a 35-year-old, the net effect of that for an average earner would be a 4.5% benefit reduction compared to the currently scheduled benefits. And for a 25-year-old, it would be an 8.5% benefit reduction. We are able to mitigate those benefit reductions, which are much smaller than under alternative plans, which rely exclusively on the benefit side, because we do bring in additional revenue for the program, including an increase in the payroll tax, which would rise from 12.4% today, that's for a worker and his or her employer combined, to 13.7% in 2045 and continue rising modestly thereafter. Just to put that increase in context, if that increase, which again won't take place for 40 years, but if it were actually in place today, the average earner would pay an extra $37 a month in combined employer and employee taxes. And we think that kind of additional revenue injection dedicated to Social Security is very important because it mitigates the required benefit reductions. I'd note that a recent poll done by Alan Blinder and Alan Krueger, two professors at Princeton, very strongly suggested that the majority of people preferred either a revenue increase or a combination of a revenue increase and a benefit reduction to exclusive reliance on benefit reductions. And yet it is striking that almost all of the major plans out there rely exclusively on benefit reductions to restore solvency, unlike our plan, which does combine the two.
Then you have a tax increase above $90,000, right, above that cap.
We impose a tax that starts at 3% above the maximum taxable earnings base. So what would happen is the payroll tax would be 12.4% or whatever our new payroll tax is, but basically 12.4% today up to a certain level and then 3% beyond that level. And we do that because higher earners, in our view, should be contributing to the program in at least some proportion to their full earnings rather than just up to $90,000. It is striking that the total amount of wages above that cap, which therefore go untaxed under the current system, exceed $800 billion, and they represent more than 15% of total wages. That's up from 10% in 1983 at the time of the last major reform. So we think some modest tax there is warranted.
So let's go through that. You have some benefit cuts. You have some payroll tax hikes. You have a surcharge for wealthy people to pay a little bit more. And then you have this some other small changes. Let's ask Maya McGinnis how she would critique your plan.
Well, I've always been very impressed that both Peter Diamond and Peter Orszag put forward this plan. It's been very helpful in furthering the debate. So there are a lot of things I think are great about it, primarily the goal of creating a balanced plan, but one that protects people who need the program the most. The critiques I have of it are, one, I think it phases in the changes too slowly. I would make these changes more quickly. We have known about the problems facing Social Security, not for years, but for decades. And in many ways, it's a failure of the political system that we have delayed and delayed, and that makes those choices harder. We know we need to make the choices as soon as possible. One of the shortcomings of this plan, in my opinion, is that it makes the choices today, but it actually implements most of them down the road. I would like to see changes that are actually implemented sooner, because that allows us to spread those costs between the generations rather than pushing them all into the future. Also, I would do more of the balance changes. I think any plan has to be balanced, and it has to include tax increases, benefit reductions, and I would increase the retirement age. I would do more on the benefit reduction side than their plan does. I think that it still relies on a lot of new revenues, which we might need for other parts of the budget also.
When we come back from a short break, we'll finish up our conversation on Social Security solvency and hear more about the 8.7 magnitude earthquake which rocked the coast of Indonesia earlier today. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But right now, we're discussing measures desperate and not. I guess there aren't very many desperate ones to keep Social Security solvent in the long run. Our guests are Peter Orszag of the Brookings Institution and Maya McGinnis of the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget. Let's talk, why don't we, about another idea that a lot of people have mentioned, and that is raising the retirement age. Maya McGinnis, what do you think of that approach, and what is the best way to implement something like that?
I have to say, it's an awfully sensible approach. We are living longer. When the program started, the retirement age was 65. Until quite recently, the retirement age was 65. It's now going up very, very gradually towards 67. And just plain and simple, we can't really afford for people to be supported by their children for a longer, longer period of their lives. We need to either find a way to get people to work longer or save more for their own retirement. But as we live longer, raising the retirement age makes a lot of sense. One way I think is worth thinking about is doing something called longevity indexing, which means rather than saying you can't retire until you're 68 or 69 or 70, adjusting benefits based on your life expectancy. So as each cohort reaches retirement and they're expected to live a little bit longer, their benefits would be adjusted downward just to reflect that. And you could still have flexibility in when people actually choose to retire.
Peter Orszag, what do you think? You don't have any rise in the retirement age in your plan, do you?
No, but we do exactly what Maya just suggested, which is we do index the system to life expectancy with the goal of offsetting the additional costs from longer lives. We split it evenly, or almost roughly evenly, between reducing benefits and increasing revenue, but the goal is to offset the cost of longer life expectancy just directly through the benefit formula. I don't think we have to do this through the retirement age. And one other point is worth noting, which is that life expectancy is increasing. There is a very dramatic gap that is widening between higher earners and lower earners. So life expectancy is going up really fast at the top of the income distribution, which by itself is making the system less progressive on a lifetime basis because higher earners increasingly get their benefits over a longer and longer number of months compared to everyone else.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, I think, when you look at the polls, which of these solutions seems to play well? Raising taxes on the rich plays very well. Raising the retirement age doesn't play very well.
Yeah, people are pretty tend to favor ways to fix the system that doesn't affect them. But I don't think that's true if you talk about the whole plan. When you talk about polling one issue at a time, certainly people have a preference for those changes which are least likely to affect them. But when we talk about all the things that are going to be necessary to create a plan that's fully balanced, I think that's unlikely to avoid something that mixes pretty much a balanced package of the three options, taxes, benefits, and I put retirement age in there as the third option and one that really does make sense.
What about the concern that some people have talked about, that is that for people who are in physical manual jobs, raising the retirement age is a very difficult thing. Peter?
Well, that's one of the reasons why the type of approach that Maya and I have talked about, which doesn't actually raise the retirement age, it just makes adjustments to the benefit formula itself, would be something to look at. And at the same time, for under a lot of the plans, including our plan and including plans put forward by the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, appointed by President Bush in 2001, it's possible to provide additional protections for lower earners and for the most vulnerable beneficiaries while still restoring solvency to the overall program. So I think that is quite important. And by the way, on the polling data, my read of it is somewhat different. I don't know that people are so affected by what they think will affect them directly as opposed to what they think is fair. People just don't think it's fair that taxes are applied only up to $90,000 and not universally. And I think we should be looking at things that speak to that sense of fairness.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email now from Reed in Salem, Oregon. He says it's a demographic issue. Could we solve it with demographics? Increase the number of immigrants allowed into the U.S. That would increase the number of workers. Maya?
There's a lot of policies that seem tempting, which have to do with getting more revenue into the system in the short run. But all of those people who are going to pay in, whether it's from opening our doors and having higher levels of immigration or encouraging people to have more children or getting state and local workers to become part of a program, they will all receive benefits down the road. So there's a difference between changing the program in a way that makes it sustainable and getting more money in today, but also having that new dollar matched with further promises in the future. Something like immigration can certainly help the program, but keep in mind that it also increases all the benefits that we currently don't have enough money to pay for that we promise for the future. So it's not in itself a way to solve the problem.
One of the ways to change the demographics is what we've just talked about, I guess. If you raise the retirement age, you define people as workers on one side of the age and as retirees on the other side, so you actually are affecting the demographics.
Well, and it's interesting because at the same time that we're going to face the problems in Social Security, we're going to have labor market shortages because we are not going to be having a labor market that grows as quickly as it has in the past. So you can broaden this debate out to beyond just Social Security and think, how are we going to have a retirement system that meets the needs of both the laborers and retirees in a world of changing demographics, which is certainly what we're in the midst of.
I guess we've got to say goodbye now and move on to our next story. Maya McGinnis, president of Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, has joined us, as has Peter Orszag of the Brookings Institution. Thank you both very much for your help in defining and figuring out how to solve this problem.
Thanks for
having us.